This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value. Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. Just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Cool Zone Media.
Hey everyone, Robert Evans here. And before we get to the episode, obviously a lot of people in Gaza need a lot of different help, but we've been connected to the Al-Ghazawi family by a friend of ours who's doing aid work there right now. They are trying to get 14 members of their family out of Gaza before, you know, things get any worse for them. And they're raising money to do so on GoFundMe. If you Google Help Al-Ghazawi Family Escape Gaza GoFundMe, you can find it. Al-Ghazawi is spelled Al-Ghazawi. Yeah, we're trying to help them, you know, get to a safer place. So please consider donating if you can.
Oh, welcome back to Behind the Bastards, the only podcast that makes you sad. That's the promise we make with Behind the Bastards, is that after listening to this episode, your life will be worse. And to help me make your life worse, the great Joe Kasabian. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I'm glad to finally get my my Behind the Bastards hat trick.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. What's the hat trick?
Oh, it's that's a sports reference that you should really know.
I was about to say, because I don't know you as a hat guy, Joe.
Hat trick means that you scored three times in one
thing.
Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So for everybody listening, they have to take their hat off and throw it somewhere, anywhere.
Okay. Okay. Well, they're all busy doing that. I'm going to throw you a story of a real piece of shit, Joe. What do you know, boy. Joe Kasabian, host of the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast, author of several books. What's your latest, Joe? I've forgotten the title.
So my latest,
you do the plugs up front now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a military science fiction series coming out. The first two books are currently out. You have the Undying. The whole series is called The Undying Legion. So if you look up the Undying Legion series or my name, you could find it. And the first two books are currently out, and the third book will be out next month.
Excellent. And you also have your work of nonfiction, The Hooligans of Kandahar. People should check out all of your books. Now, you know who didn't write fiction, but did lie enough to be considered a fiction writer?
Oh, boy.
Lavrenti Beria. What do you know about Lavrenti Beria?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh,
I would be brought in for Beria, wouldn't I?
Yeah, of course. he is. If you've watched The Death of Stalin, he's the bad guy. I mean, everyone is the bad guy in The Death of Stalin, except for maybe Zhukov, but he's the bad guy in The Death of Stalin. That's
he's
who
the
we're
bad
talking
guy
about.
In everything.
He was the bad guy in real life, too. One of them, you know? We open, like, a lot of our episodes with, like, comparisons to usually the Nazis, right? We'll call King Leopold the Hitler of African colonialism, or, like, the British Empire slow Nazis. Because Nazis are, like, everyone's touchstone for the absolute depths of human evil. And one of the things that's interesting about Lavrenti Beria is that Stalin himself compared him to a Nazi during the Yalta. I think it was the Yalta conference when he's talking to like FDR. He calls Beria our Himmler. Like, that's how he introduces Beria to the president. Like, this is my Himmler. Yeah, yeah, I got one too.
We all got a Himmler.
Well, everybody's like got a Himmler,
or
right?
Churchill. It's like FDR or Churchill like said Stalin is a bastard, but he's our bastard. He's like, yeah, he's Himmler, but he's our Himmler.
He's our Himmler. It's cool. We got one. I actually don't agree with that comparison. He's not much like Himmler. I guess he kind of, you know, Himmler runs the SS, Beria runs the secret police, because that's the comparison. But like, Himmler is a hardcore believer, right? Himmler's not like a fair weather Nazi. He's like into the occult. He's got a castle where he's doing rituals and shit. Like, one thing you could say about Himmler is he believed all that kooky nonsense.
Really into witches.
I don't think Beria believed. I don't think Beria was really like in his. I don't think Beria was a communist, and that was like the system he worked in. But I don't think he was like a hardcore believer. Right.
No.
Beria was a power guy. Right. And he was going to do whatever would get him into power.
I think he was the kind of guy. My knowledge of Beria is like he would have glommed on to any system that would allow him to do what he did.
Right. Right. He would have at least attempted to, which I don't do to like take any blame away from the horrible state communist system that existed in the USSR, particularly under Stalin. It's just that's not the kind of dude Beria was. He was a consummate opportunist. And that's kind
of
what's interesting
about
it. It's just the love of the game. He just loves being an asshole in a government. You know, he would have tried to find his way.
And he excels at his job.
He was such a good piece of shit. I had a line in here about how he's got a body count only rivaled by these Australian dudes I met once in a Berlin hostel. But I wasn't sure if that was an obvious enough joke.
Oh, God.
don't room next to Australians in a hostel, guys. It's just a mess. You know that it's true. Australians
don't room next to Australians anywhere. Don't like,
stay away. That's why they're on that island. You know,
they need to be there. It's the only thing that contains them is the isolation and countless venomous animals that will murder them if they step out of line.
When you get kicked out of the UK for being too much of a hooligan, you know, it says something.
You know, there's one thing I can say positive of Australia is I love the national pastime of hooning.
Yes. I have to give them shit because Australians and Texans are the two peoples on the world that are like closest in their overall temperament. And neither of us likes to hear it, but it's undeniable when you spend time with both.
Australia is Texas if Texas wasn't connected to anything else.
Yeah,
if we were allowed to exist in a vacuum.
Speaking of Texas, a lot of people say the Texas of Eastern Europe is Georgia. I don't know if anyone's ever said that, Joe.
Actually, as someone who lived in both Texas and Georgia, I'll allow it.
Well, that's where our friend Beria is born. And Georgia, the country, is in a tough historic position. If you just look at a map, you have a vague knowledge of like the last 1,000 years, you can like put together in your head some of the problems Georgia was likely to have had, right? They're kind of in the middle. If you're the Turks, right? If you're the Ottomans, Georgia's in the way of where you want to get to, right?
Man, that sounds familiar.
If you're Europe, Georgia's also in the way of getting to places you want to go. If you're Russia, Georgia's in the way. They're just kind of, they're one of those speed bump countries, and they're going to wind up having kind of a tumultuous history as a result of just kind of being in the middle of a bunch of shit. So by the end of the 1700s, Russia has won most of eastern Georgia in a gentleman's game of murder each other with the Ottomans. Russian interest in the area peaked whenever the Turks looked tired or weak and would fade whenever Turkey looked like it really wanted to throw hands. By the middle of the 1800s, this tug of war had gone Russia's way often enough that most of Georgia winds up in possession of the Czars, who treated the Georgians about as carefully as they treated everything else, right? Not great. It's not great.
About as great as Russia currently treats Georgians within its borders.
Yeah, that's a generally accurate way to look at it. So Georgians, by and large, are not thrilled with this situation. But since the Turks hadn't really been any better, some of them started looking at some radical solutions to their having a government problem. And socialism's kind of the new hotness at this point. So in Georgia, socialism is kind of, it becomes kissing cousins with nationalism, right? And by the start of the 1900s, there were two broad socialist groups that were kind of gaining influence in Georgia. You got your Mensheviks and you got your Bolsheviks. Bolsheviks basically means the majority party. And Mensheviks means the minority party, but the Mensheviks are much more numerous than the Bolsheviks. It's a little bit of a fuck game there, right? The Mensheviks are kind of, it's not really accurate to view them as social democrats the way we know them, but they're closer to that than what becomes the government of the Soviet Union, right? And that sounds pretty good to a lot of Georgians. And so the Mensheviks are larger, they're more organized than the Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks are going to spend all of subsequent history pretending it had always been the other way around, right?
This, again, that sounds very familiar. The yes. exact same, like, I'm Armenian, and Georgians and Armenians are, like, they're brothers, culturally yeah. very, very, very similar. Even in our own revolutionary history of, like, the First Republic of Armenia, the conflict between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks is mm-hmm. literally identical.
Yes,
it's through the Caucasus in general, the story yeah. is, the story rhymes.
And this is, you know, Beria is a little more Georgia-focused, but he spends most of his early career in Azerbaijan, and he is kind of, his whole life, his whole early political career is in the Transcaucasus. Because, as you said, you can't really separate Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia during this kind of revolutionary period in what had once been the Russian Empire. Like, they're all very tied together.
Once they became their one country.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So our subject for this week, Lavrenti, is born right in the middle of this kind of surge in socialist organizing in Georgia on March 29th, 1899. So I believe he's an Aries Pisces cusp. The worst.
I don't know anything about signs. I just know whenever a sign is pronounced, the people that I mm-hmm. know that are into them always just like sigh heavily. Like,
of course.
Oh, God. that's exactly what he is.
That's always my response whenever somebody brings up, like, oh yeah, and this famous person is this sign. You roll your eyes and go, oh God, obviously. They couldn't be more whatever move. You just said.
Becoming the head of the NKVD, what a Pisces move.
That's classic. It's right on the Pisces. Yeah, doing the Caden massacre, Katian massacre. That's a classic Aries shit, right? Not surprised he's got yeah. both in him. Yeah,
you wouldn't expect that from, say, a Cancer.
Oh God, no. I'm sure one of the Nazis was a Cancer. They all kind of were. Anyway, Lavrenti Pavlovich Beria becomes a baby March 29th, 1899. He's born in a small village, Merkuli, which is kind of out in the boonies near the Black Sea coast. His family are Mingrelian, which is an ethnic minority in Georgia with its own language, but not a written one. So they use the Georgian language for writing, but they've also got their own language that's kind of just an oral tradition. The fact that he's Mingrelian is going to become relevant much later, near the end of his life, because Mingrelians are different, right? They're not the same as everyone else in Georgia. And in the late Stalinist period, anyone who's part of an ethnic group that isn't Russian or mainstream Georgian is going to have a bad time. Right?
Unfortunately, still kind of currently true as well.
Still, this is, if you know one period in Russian history, there's some broad strokes you'll be accurate about in most of it, right?
Yeah.
So Beria's Georgia was considered by Western Europeans to be among the most backwards parts of the continent. One visitor in 1891 from Germany claimed they didn't even know about crop rotation, which might speak more to his racism than actual agricultural practice, but it's undeniable that this was seen as the middle of nowhere in most people's eyes. And as a result, it's much more culturally isolated than most parts of the Western Russian Empire. It's not a very cosmopolitan place. Beria's mother, Marta Ivanova, was 27 when she had him, which is pretty late in that
yeah.
period.
It's surprising. I was expecting you to say 14 or something.
Yeah. It's late. I mean, she'd had some other kids, I think, before. And she is described by Beria biographer Amy Knight as a, quote, simple, deeply religious woman who attended church regularly all her life. Some sources, including Knight's biography, claim she came from a noble background, although it was a branch of the nobility that had no money. Another biographer I read, a guy named Sangster, and a couple other people have come in to argue that he wasn't probably had no noble blood. It was kind of a rumor. Might have been like a family legend. We've got this ancestry, but there's not evidence of it. But a lot of this comes down to like family lore as opposed to something that
it's very much a Caucasian thing to have like deep family lore that is not at all grounded in reality. It like started as like your great great uncle once removed story and then like spreads throughout your family until it's just spoken as just unassailable fact.
And it's tough because part of it, there's almost certainly everyone has some noble ancestry because nobles fuck a lot of their servants and have a lot of illegitimate children. Like Stalin is going to be taken care of by this rich guy his mom worked for, right? Like this rich guy is going to give them a lot of money and Barry, his mom's going to have the same situation. And we don't know, well, is it just because she worked for this guy? He considered her part of the family, so he helped out. Is it because they were stupen? Is it because there's like that he had an illegitimate kid with her, right? Like we'll never know, you know?
Maybe she's working the whole time, you know?
Maybe she's working the whole time, right? Maybe she's got a little bit of Nancy Reagan magic. Nothing against that, you know?
Bury a family, the McGrellian throat goats.
So it's interesting to note that a lot of Marxist rebel, Marxist leaders, because all Marxists are kind of members of an illegal party in this period, whether you're kind of more on the Menshevik or the Bolshevik side, the Tsar doesn't like what you're doing. Most of the leaders of these Marxist organizations have a background where there's some nobility. A lot of them come from the cashless nobility, which is like a big thing all throughout Europe. You've got like your nobles who are rich and you've got your nobles who squandered everything. So they've got the blood, but nothing else.
I know which ones I respect more.
Yes. And a lot of leftist leaders in this period, particularly of youth organizations, are these like cashless nobles. And it makes sense because they tend to benefit from much more of an education, but they're not really, even though they're nobles, they're not really the same class as the people with money because they don't have any fucking money. So it's not hard to see, right? Like why that would be the case. Marta's got a pretty difficult life. Her first marriage gives her one son who dies young. Her husband dies too. So she marries again. She has three more kids. One of them, Anna, is born deaf and mute. Another, who is Beria's brother, we know nothing about. So he probably died young too. And then she's got Beria, who's the only boy we know survived to adulthood. And by the way, her second marriage with Beria's dad ends the same way as the first, in that her husband dies. The Beria family husbands have a proud tradition of dying instantly after making kids.
We don't know if Lavrenti had something to do with any of this or not.
It's not a 0% chance, right?
If someone told me, like, you know, when he was barely able to walk, he sank a knife into someone's neck, I'd be like, yeah, probably.
You hear a lot about like, you know, this kid killed his mom in childbirth or whatever, right? Common story. Beria pops out with a knife and shanks his dad right in the gut.
I mean, from my own family history, you know what? I'm okay with this.
So Beria is going to be the only boy to make it to adulthood. And it's probably not surprising that Marta dotes on him, right? He is a mama's boy. And Stalin is as well. And another thing I've noticed when you read about a lot of the more influential like rebel leaders in Russia in this period, decent number of them are mama's boys, you know?
Huh.
So if you want your kid to overthrow the government, spoil them a little bit, moms, you know? It's good for them.
You know, maybe I was also a mama's boy growing up, so I guess I'm just waiting for my time.
Yeah, no. Don't let the immigration board hear that.
I already got my residency card, motherfuckers.
So one of his peers later recalled that he, quote, grew up on the hands of his mother who earned by her sewing. So that's kind of how she keeps the lights on, although the lights are not like electric lights. So she actually keeps the lights on by.
It's how you buy the candles.
Yeah, buying candles. Yeah. So here's how Knight describes Lavrenti as an adolescent in the book Beria, Stalin's First Lieutenant. Beria was a mediocre student, not excelling in any subject, but considered cunning and devious. After completing school in Sukhumi in 1915, Beria went to the city of Baku in Azerbaijan, where he enrolled in the Baku Polytechnical School for Mechanical Construction, remaining there for the next 4 years. Beria probably chose Baku for his studies instead of Tbilisi, which was much closer to home because it offered the specific course he was interested in. Nonetheless, Baku was almost 600 kilometers from home, quite a distance for a boy of only 16. Beria says in his autobiography that he supported himself, his mother, his sister, and young niece by doing office work during school vacations. Now, these claims that Beria is a shitty student, but, you know, supports his family and somehow gets into Baku Polytechnic are primarily supported by a family friend and later comrade in the USSR government named Danilov. And Danilov is the guy who's like, yeah, he wasn't book smart. He was a shitty student, but he's just cunning. We get a different version of what happened in a summary of Beria I found on globalsecurity.org, which is a think tank founded in 2000 that focuses on defense and foreign policy. Bob Woodward likes them. I don't know much more about them beyond that, but they seem to be relatively credible, and this scans with some other things I've read. In school, Beria did very well. As the best student, the villagers' pride, he went to study in Sukumi. Apparently, they always moved in vain desire to advance, to be the first in any cost. And this is kind of a discrepancy you'll get. Like, Beria is either this shitty student who's super, you know, cunning and gets by on being a schemer, or he's a pretty good student who's, like, really well-respected in town because he's this local boy who does well. The fact that there are discrepancies in this and almost every other fact about the man comes down to the fact that most of what we know about Beria comes from either co-workers who later helped to murder him and thus wanted to make him look bad, or his own cult of personality, right? Which is also full of shit. So it is it is really hard to know much for certain about particularly his early life. Polish writer Thaddeus Whitlen, an early Beria biographer, even called Beria the man without history. Of course, Andrew Sangster notes, he then spends pages on his early life, how he dressed and even his thought processes, how he behaved in school. And from this, the reader can only assume it is mere conjecture. So, again, like, there's so much bullshit about this guy, even in the pretty good biographies. And I'm not shitting on Knight here. I think her book is generally quite good. But, like, there's just a lot of maybes with Beria.
I think that's kind of part and parcel with a guy like Beria, right? Like,
yes.
When he comes to power, he's known for being terrifying, which, you know, obviously we'll get to. And one of the most terrifying things you can do, and something that he had the power to do, was erase his own history. Then you can't use it against him.
Right. And that's a part of it. And also, one thing Sangster will note is that most early Beria biographies are written after his execution, when he becomes, so Stalin dies, they kill Beria, and guys like Khrushchev comes into power next, and Khrushchev and everyone who kind of survives from the Stalinist era, they're all complicit in the crimes of the Stalinist era, and they all want to blame everything that went bad in that period on Beria, because it really works out well for them. So the books about him in this period are basically just novels with Beria as the villain. And he was a villain, but that doesn't mean everything in those novels is true, right?
Yeah.
For his part, Sangster agrees that Beria was actually probably a really good student, and I kind of think he's right about this, because from what I've read, Baku Polytechnic's a pretty competitive school, and it's not super common for kids like Beria from poor villages to go there if they're not really good students, you know?
Yeah, I mean, far be it for me to say anything positive about the city of Baku, but everything written about the Polytechnic is very, very good. I've never heard it as, like, you know, it's not a schlup school or anything like that, and especially being from a village, being from a cashless noble family, or just maybe a regular poor
just
family, whichever
poor family.
It may be, you had to show some kind of promise in order to get in, and they're not going to allow some dumbass who's coasting by on mediocre grades but is quote-unquote cunning. You can't judge cunning on standardized testing.
Yeah, maybe if he was getting like an English degree where bullshitting was part, but he's like in architecture, right? You presume he had to show some promise.
It's always the fucking architects, Robert. You can't trust them.
Look, I've been saying this for years, Joe. We have to kill all the architects, you know? And I know that's half of our listeners. We're huge among architects, but you're all the death of this world. And
you can't trust them. I don't know what it is. That's a lot like horses. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Just don't trust them.
No horses, no architects. That's the new anarchist flag I'm gonna try to get people to adopt.
That's right.
But if you hate architects, you know who's working to destroy them all and end all laws about how you can and can't build a house? Our sponsors. So buy from them and help them lobby Congress to make it legal to do your own electrical work. You know? It's safe. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up right after the winter. It's warmer earlier than ever right now, so maybe you're getting pressured more often than you used to in March to get out into the world and be around people. It's hard to determine what the right amount of socializing is for you and how to recharge. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to figure this kind of stuff out so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery and maybe even makes it bigger. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. Therapy is useful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It can empower you to be a better version of yourself, and it's not just for people who have experienced major trauma. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire, and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/behind today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/behind. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
We're back, and I just, in the break, rewired my entire home. I've found out that if you don't put that plastic coat around the wires, it really cuts down on the weight, you know, of your house, which is helpful.
Yeah, and now I have nothing but mail-to-mail plugs, like the suicide plugs, holding all of my equipment together. I'm really happy they ponied up the money to get, like, you know, awareness out there for Rube Goldberg s ways to kill yourself with electricity. I'm all on board for it.
Actually, Sophie, can we get a sponsorship from the people who make those mail to mail plugs on Amazon that burn down your house and kill your family?
I think that's
I'll read an ad for them.
Probably not. I would just assume no.
Buy them anyway, folks. They're probably safe.
It's speaking the only of product probably. You only ever have to buy once.
Yeah, exactly. Beria would have liked them. He liked killing people. So there's a weird mention by one of the first Soviets to chronicle Beria's life, that he and his family were supported by cash gifts from a wealthy noble that his mom worked as a servant for. Kind of, again, makes me wonder if she was maybe getting some strange. There are rumors that actually Beria might be this guy's son. It's plausible, but you get this, like, literally the same thing happened with Stalin. So I think the fact is just this is not a really uncommon social relationship. Like, if your mom was hot in rural Georgia, she probably had like a wealthy patron, right? And why not? It's hard to get by back then, you know? Your husband's gonna die three times in your life. You need money from somewhere.
I mean, what are your options? You, like, you're a penniless dirt farmer, or you let some like rich guy clap them cheeks for like 15 seconds every two weeks.
Who wouldn't?
Me up.
I'm on board. I'm on. Well, no, actually, you and I are both dying at age 19 after fathering our fifth child.
In the classic tradition.
So when Beria was 5 or 6, Russia gets convulsed by revolution for the first time in his life. We know now that this was the prelude to the 1917 revolution, but at the time, a lot of people would have seen the complete and devastating crackdown by the Tsar as evidence that the regime was pretty strong, right? You get this, this does not go well, and the Tsar kills so many fucking people. Now, in those days, again, the left-wing opponents of the Tsarist system are Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. The Bolsheviks are a tightly centralized party led by Lenin, who is not in country for a lot of this period. And they want
He's
a
in
one
Germany,
party.
Right?
he's in Germany for a spell. I think he moves around a bit. I'm not an expert on his whole movements, but he's out of the country leading from afar for most of Beria's early life. And the Bolsheviks are very centralized. They're a one party state that wants one party control of a proletarian dictatorship, right? That's the whole idea. Mm. The Mensheviks are, again, closer to social democrats, and as a result, are more popular for most of Beria's childhood, because most people generally prefer not one party rule to one party rule. That does change rapidly at points, but
whenever anybody throws around a term like dictatorship, it's a turnoff.
I'm not on board. I'm not generally on board. Now, in this case, you can debate like if your choice is dictatorship of the proletariat to the czar. I don't think you're wrong in saying like, well, let's try anything but having a fucking czar. I get it. You know,
like, if I was ruled by Tsar Nicholas, I would accept anything that is not Tsar Nicholas.
Anything that's not the czar. It makes sense to me. Logical step. From the age of 16 on, Beria is going to be his mother's primary means of financial support, which means that he's able to, when he moves to Baku, kind of one of the things he does, he gets involved in socialist organizing. And one of his jobs for the student organization he's in, because he's working full time, he has a lot of connections with workers that are also organized in different Marxist like unions and stuff. And he's able to make connections between the student group that he's at the college and these like laborers who are not super educated, right? So that's kind of his earliest job as a not even quite a revolutionary, but certainly an activist at this stage.
More just like your run-of-the-mill organizer at the time.
Yeah. Now, to note, though, there is a revolutionary aspect to even being run-of-the-mill as an organizer, because this is still treason, right? Like, this is illegal, you know? Light treason, you might call it, but treason nonetheless.
You're still going to get a visit by some dudes who are going to drag you into a dark basement.
Right. The Okhrana is not going to be thrilled with what you're getting up to. And by the time the big dub-dub Uno is underway, that's World War I. Everyone hates it when I use those terms for them.
I got to say, I'm not a fan.
Nobody likes it. I don't like it, but I'm doing it. Much like having a czar. It's just one of those things that can't change until there's a bloody revolution. So... you know,
I guess I'm gonna have to revisit Oregon.
Anyway, so by the time World War I starts, he's 16 or so, and he and several fellow students set up an illegal study circle poring over the works of Marxist theory. Beria is treasurer of the group, and in March of 1917, he joins the Bolshevik Party. Now, this only happens, he only becomes a Bolshevik after the revolution gets that czar out of their hair, right? They wash him out. And prior to that point, Beria is into, again, radical politics, but we don't have any evidence of him participating in, like, armed revolutionary activity. So right after he joins the Bolshevik Party, he gets conscripted into the army, and he's sent to the Romanian front to serve as essentially a combat engineer, right? I think he's actually doing, like, hydraulic shit, probably to make sure that troops have water, is as best as I can term it.
Yeah, make sure this water only has the minimum amount of cholera necessary.
Yeah. You don't want too little cholera, right? Yeah. Like, you know, a growing soldier needs some cholera.
Yeah, it makes you strong. Like, World War One is one of those things. It's like there's so many episodes in that arc that would make the world a much better place if a bullet sailed just like 5 centimeters to the left or the right.
Oh, my God. There's that sad, sad story about that British sniper who has Hitler in his sights. And we know this is true because, like, he remembered it. And Hitler's like, I saw this guy get a bead on me. And the Brit was like, well, the fighting was basically over. They were in retreat. And I was like, I don't want one more boy to die today. And you can't blame a man for doing that. But
at
if
time,
only,
yeah.
if
Man,
only
that motherfucker must have kicked his own ass harder than anyone else.
It's one of those moments from history where it's like, what is the lesson here? Kill more teenagers? Like what
the lesson
what do we
that I'm taking from this?
This
is never take mercy on your enemies because one of them might be Hitler.
It's like that woman who like stops Hitler from committing suicide by trying to like talk him out of it. And it's like, what do you get from this? Like, where do we
she
draw
nestles
a conclusion?
Alongside Hitler, puts her arm around her, is like, have you heard of BetterHelp?
Don't learn lessons from history, people. That's the primary lesson of this podcast. Ignore everything I say and get on with your life.
Especially if you've got a motherfucker in your crosshairs and he has a weird little mustache, you have no choice. Look,
shoot anyone with a mustache. That's really the lesson. So by this point, when Beria gets sent to the Romanian front, Russia is, the Tsar is no longer in power, and the government that replaces it is essentially democratic, right? The Bolsheviks are not in charge yet. This is not the USSR. It's kind of a socialist democratic state. It's not a very functional socialist democratic state, right? Which is why some other things are going to happen, right? Yeah, and this is the Caucasus, so things are even like a little messier. But this ailing new democracy is still fighting the Tsar's war, right? Which is a bad call. They probably should have done something besides continuing to fight World War One.
It seemed like an easy own goal. It's like, you know, this really unpopular war that drove people to revolution. I have an idea. What if we keep doing it?
Yeah, let's keep throwing down with the Germans.
What if we just fed another generation of our men into a meat grinder to make some kind of multi-ethnic mush?
Yeah, yeah. Great call. So it doesn't go well, right? And there's going to be a Bolshevik revolution. I think we're all familiar with kind of the broad terms of this. And this is when Beria kind of gets involved, right? During this very chaotic period, he becomes the Bolshevik party representative for his military unit, because all of the units have like effectively these unions, and his is a Bolshevik one. And when the war finally ends, he moves back to Baku, where the Bolsheviks are now ascendant. In the rest of Azerbaijan, I think it's still more Menshevik, but like Baku, the Bolsheviks are really starting to pick up a lot of steam. And he gets a position on the staff of the head of the Baku Soviet of Workers' Deputies, right? So it's kind of just because he's known as, and this again makes me think those things about him not being a good student are not accurate. He keeps getting positions that are kind of high despite not having much experience, because the stuff he's doing is always like he's the treasurer, he's organizing, he's doing like bureaucratic shit, because most people don't want to do that. And he's got an organizer brain, right? He's good at organizing like departments and shit. And he's willing to do that kind of boring but necessary work to lay the grounds to like actually have a large organization that does shit. And that's why he keeps getting put in positions, because like most people want to do the sexy stuff. And Barry is like, I'll do the hard bullshit paperwork stuff. It's not bullshit. Like,
but, I mean, that's the key to power, is doing the stuff that nobody else wants to do and doing it well. Yeah.
Again, I say this a lot. This is also the story of like Ceausescu. If you overthrow the government and are running a revolutionary party, and there's a quiet little dude who doesn't say much, but he's always taking on bullshit work, and, you know, really helpful, shoot that guy immediately. Immediately. You know?
He volunteers to run the people's DMV. Take that motherfucker immediately.
Yeah, exactly. That man needs to end up in a fucking quiet little grave. So this was not an auspicious time to be helping to run the Baku Soviet. Because with Russia, you know, breaking out in revolution, a lot of people are like trying to take advantage of this. And one of the peoples trying to take advantage of this as a result of the war is Turkey, right? And Turkey's like, maybe we can have a little Azerbaijan as a treat. So they invade and they wind up in charge of Baku for a little while in 1918. They are not in power there long, because spoiler, after 1918, the Ottoman Empire doesn't do great.
No.
Doesn't do very well.
Man, but they sure did a lot of damage before they finally died.
They sure did. They went out like heroes. If heroes are constantly fucking up everything around them. They went out like a dying empire, I guess is probably better to say. So pretty soon, you know, the Turks are back out, and the Bolsheviks kind of wind up in quasi-power. You know, they have a lot of power in the city after the Turks leave. They're not in absolute power, and they're kind of fighting with another party for actual control of the city. Now, Beria, being young enough that he's not yet well-known in politics, is picked to be a mole for this party, the Musavat Party, that are kind of have turned themselves into the primary opposition of the Bolsheviks. And they are, to this day, the oldest party in Azerbaijan still. They spend long periods of time kicked out of the area, exiled, a lot of their people get killed, but they still do exist. And Beria, being, you know, a pretty young guy, and being this dude who, he's had some prominent roles, so he's got some trust in the Bolsheviks, but he's also not a face man, right? Like, he's somebody that, like, is not super well-known personally, is picked as a perfect mole to infiltrate the Musavat Party. And I'm going to quote from that write-up in Global Security. He worked as a clerk at the Caspian Company, White City, performed various assignments trapped underground. In the fall of 1919, Beria joined the counterintelligence of the Committee of National Defense of the Azerbaijan Republic. Subsequently, this period of Beria's life caused a lot of rumors. It was said that he consciously worked on the Azerbaijani nationalists and even was an agent of the British. And you'll basically get claims that he was working every side of, like, the political conflicts in Azerbaijan in this period. Some people will say he was actually a Musavat agent, like spying on the Bolsheviks. He was a Bolshevik spying on the Musavats. He was like spying for the British on everybody. There's no real evidence for most of that. I think the likeliest thing here is that he is spying for the Bolsheviks on the Musavat party.
I do love the idea that a Georgian guy messy. Is like a hardline Azerbaijani nationalist.
yeah, that he's like, he's going hard for that. which, like, spoiler, he's not at all an Azerbaijani nationalist. He is going to kill a lot of Azerbaijani nationalists, along with a lot of Armenian and Georgian nationalists. That's going to be his first real big gig for the USSR.
This is what happens when you give someone from the Caucasus power over the Caucasus.
Yeah.
Because nobody hates us more than we hate ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, much like Texans.
Exactly.
So if you read more casual articles about Beria, they will all note that he's a member of this anti-Bolshevik Musavat party. And calling them anti-Bolshevik is like not entirely, it's close enough if you're getting like a broad summary of what's going on there. But I think Amy Knight's biography does a better job of contextualizing who these folks were and what Beria did with them. Quote, "The Musavat Party had originally been formed in 1911 to 1912 by a group of intellectuals associated with the RSDRP. It later shifted ideologically to the right and became the party of the rising Azerbaijani bourgeoisie. After a period of cooperation with the Bolsheviks in Baku, during which they supported the Soviet, the Musavatists increasingly opposed Bolshevik policies. By late 1917 and early 1918, they had become the Bolsheviks' most formidable rivals. In the autumn of 1919, Beria was assigned by the Bolsheviks to conduct counterintelligence within the ruling Musavat government." So you have this party that is, it starts as an intellectual party that's pretty left-wing, but like social democrat, right? And they're willing to work with the Bolsheviks in Baku for a period of time when kind of in the most chaotic post-revolutionary period. But as the Bolsheviks start to gain power and it becomes clear that they are not willing to compromise or share power with anyone else, the Musavatists, in part because they represent a lot of people in the bourgeoisie, but also because they just aren't a one-party state, increasingly reform themselves as an opposition party to the Bolsheviks, right? And that's kind of what happens here. And again, you can find sources who say Beria's working with them legitimately, and that wouldn't be so weird because he's an opportunist and they are in power for a period of time. So it's not impossible right. that he's doing both. That, like, he's really trying to hedge his bets here. He's feeding some information to the Bolsheviks in case the Bolsheviks win, but he's also trying to help the Musavatists because maybe they're going to win. And Beria is this kind of, like, wherever the wind blows is kind of where I'm going to try to make, you know, a place for myself, right?
If he was alive now, he would just work for, like, the Young Turks Network or something.
Yeah.
Once that audience failed, he'd just go work for Ben Shapiro, you know?
Mm-hmm. He is one of these guys who, like, would absolutely have made a hard right turn if that had been the way to gain power, right? But the whites are never really, like, I don't think there's ever a period where they're, like, winning well enough where he is that he would have considered that, right?
Right.
But it does kind of look like there's a period where he's willing to maybe make his peace with the Musavats, you know, if that's going to be who winds up in power. But, you know, we don't really know. And certainly the Bolsheviks believe that he is legitimately spying on the Musavatists for them, right? And this is going to become a problem for Beria right away, because while he's going to get a bunch of other gigs spying, you know, back in Georgia, the Bolsheviks are going to keep using him as a spy. In like 1920, not long after this period, after the Bolsheviks win, he's going to be tried by the Central Committee in Azerbaijan for being a Musavatist spy. And the case is resolved in his favor. But every time he gets in trouble within the party, the allegations come back up, because it's the easiest way to, like, fuck with him, right? Is to point out that, like, well, you did this at one point. We don't really know whose side you were on.
That's a good example of, like, how he becomes the guy he is, because he got picked as a spy, being disloyal or whatever, goes to trial, gets away with it. He's like, in the future, he's like, well, that's never going to happen again.
Yeah. Now, one thing that definitely suggests he was a legitimate spy for the Bolsheviks is, again, they keep using him as one. And after the Bolsheviks kind of gain the upper hand in Baku, he gets sent back home to Georgia to do some spying, right? And in Georgia, in Tbilisi, the Mensheviks are in charge, right? They are the dominant party when he gets sent there, and the Bolsheviks are not cool with this. So they have guys like Beria go among the peasants to try to prod them into maybe overthrowing the government again and seeing if that works out better for everybody. So Beria moves to Tbilisi, where he constructs his very first spying network. And Joe, do you remember when you constructed your first spying network to overthrow the government in power?
Oh, I was but a young boy.
Yeah. You make a lot of mistakes, right? We all make a lot of mistakes when we're overthrowing a political party. You know, it happens. And that's going to, this is a messy period for Beria. I'm going to quote from Knight's biography here. Not surprisingly, he was soon arrested, along with the entire Bolshevik Central Committee in Georgia. Thanks to the efforts of the Georgian Bolshevik Georgi Sturia, Beria was freed on the condition that he leave Georgia within 3 days. But he remained, adopting the false name Lakerbia and working in the Russian embassy. So he, like, makes this promise to leave, and then instead of leaving, he flees to the embassy, and he gets right back to working as a spy to try to over, because this is the Russian embassy, and the Russian government is controlled by the Bolsheviks at this point. I know this is a very messy period of time, right?
Right, this would have been, what, the first Georgian Republic period. So
right, yes. Yeah. And so he is hiding out in the Russian embassy because that is a Bolshevik embassy, and still continuing to work to try to overthrow the Mensheviks in Georgia. And kind of right around this time, the Russian government concludes a treaty with Georgia. But like most treaties between Russia and a neighbor, it's more of a wink by the Russians than a promise. The Mensheviks take their side of the treaty seriously, though, and they free all of the imprisoned Bolsheviks who had just tried to overthrow the government, and they even make it legal for the Bolsheviks to have meetings and publish newspapers again. The Mensheviks are really, this is again another lesson, don't give anyone the benefit of the doubt in a revolution, you know?
Yeah. When like, someone tries to overthrow the government, maybe you like keep them in prison.
Right? Yes. Maybe this is relevant in the United States. I don't know.
Perhaps.
I've never read anything about our recent history. So when the latest Bolshevik plot to take power is revealed, because they try again, Beria gets arrested again. And he goes on a hunger strike, but it's like one of those he skips dinner hunger strikes, you know? it doesn't last very long. And he gets sent out of Georgia on a prison convoy. By August, he's back in Azerbaijan, and he gets back to being a student. He kind of goes back to school for a while, and he catches a side gig for the Bolsheviks, who at this point are doing very well in Baku. But Lenin has demanded at this point that Azerbaijan be brought over into what's becoming the USSR wholesale. And the Bolsheviks in Baku start a serious effort to do just that. It's possible that this is when Beria meets Stalin for the first time, because Stalin, as part of this effort that Lenin's pushing, gives a speech in Baku in November of 1920. Now, at this time, Beria's specific job is executive secretary of the Extraordinary Commission for the Expropriation of the Bourgeoisie and the Improvement of Working Life.
Man, they love titles.
They fucking love titles. That's too long for a job title, right? And what that job actually is he's taking shit from, like, rich people and middle class people and theoretically splitting it up among the working class. Now, how much of that gets split up and how much of that gets lost to rampant corruption? Well, it's Azerbaijan, you know?
Thankfully, that has changed.
Let's be fair. It's the Caucasus, right? Like, it's Eastern Europe.
Like, again, yeah. Thankfully, this no longer happens.
Mm-hmm. It's a place populated by humans, so a lot of it disappears into corruption. Knight writes of this period in his life, "This organization was charged with forcibly seizing property on behalf of the Bolsheviks, a rather unsavory business, and Beria again was doing the paperwork. When the commission was abolished in February 1921, Beria took the opportunity to persuade the Central Committee to support him in his studies as an architect builder. He received a stipend from the Baku Soviet, but only after a couple of weeks the Central Committee made him abandon his studies to work in the Azerbaijan political police, the infamous Cheka." And this is when he becomes a secret policeman. And that's what we're going to get to after this next ad break. So be the secret police in your life and arrest these products into your home.
Cop. They'll tell people to be cops.
But cops of products, Sophie.
Don't tell people to be cops.
Is it a cop or is it a spy or is it both?
Yeah, both. Spy on these products, whatever it takes to get them into your home, you know? That's what we believe.
Don't listen to him.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black. Directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R. Under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
We're back. So the Cheka are the secret police in Georgia and Azerbaijan and everywhere, right? And they're going to go through several. This is what ends up the different Chekas all eventually end up as the NKVD, right? Which all eventually ends up as the KGB. You know, this is like a process, right?
If there's one thing the Soviet Union likes more than titles, it's changing those titles arbitrarily.
My God. So many. I'm going to call them the Cheka for most of the period before, like, Beria is in Moscow and the USSR is fully settled, but they go through some different names, right? But it's generally, everyone still generally calls them the Cheka at various points because they're still the secret police, right? Whatever titles they're picking.
Right.
This is the position where Beria is going to truly shine, because the first big task the Bolsheviks need from him is to overthrow the Armenian government. Now, Joe, have you ever tried to overthrow the Armenian government?
I cannot legally answer that question.
Well, it's a whole thing, right? It's this, you got to do, there's some steps.
How the fuck did I make it this long in life without knowing Beria was involved in the overthrow of the First Armenian Republic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And of course he came from Azerbaijan to do it. Oh, God damn it.
Yeah. Well, at this point he's coming in from Georgia, but through Baku, right? Ah, they're in the mix.
The bridge is there. It's fine.
It's clear. So, there's a lot that you have to do to overthrow the First Armenian Republic, and Beria, along with several of his colleagues, put together different plans for how they might make this happen, right? And it's one of those things where, like, there's a lot of, like, different pitches, and Beria's is kind of the one that winds up being the kind of basis for the plan they eventually execute.
And I've been in a lot of writer's room, and I feel like a writer's room with Lavrenti Beria would be the worst one ever.
It is. It's a terrible writer's room. He's always suggesting fucking bottle episodes. So Beria's boss is a guy named Mirkafar Bagarov. He's just a 24-year-old who's in head of the Baku Cheka. He's got a reputation for brutality, and he likes Beria because Beria is willing to do fucking anything. He is perfectly willing to get his hands dirty. Oh, so God. At 21, Beria gets promoted to be Bagarov's assistant. And this is, you know, the start of a fairly rapid series of promotions. Because people are killing and dying so rapidly, it's easy to move up if you're really willing to kill, you know? And it's interesting, Bagarov is kind of the only guy other than Stalin, maybe, that Beria ever works under without later overthrowing or killing. Right. This is like one of the very few people who is Beria's boss that he does not murder or otherwise help to destroy.
I wonder what the difference was, because it wouldn't be like dirt. Like Beria was more than comfortable killing people who had dirt on him.
Yeah. I think
they were actually friends. It was like Beria's one friend.
Yeah, they might have just kind of been buds. And also, I think it's that, like, he knows Bagarov is never really rising above a certain level. So he doesn't need to, right? He kind of can leapfrog over him without fucking him, And it's useful to have a guy like Bagarov who like owes you a favor that you can, you know, trust.
That's more as much as Barry trusts. Sounds more likely than Barry having an actual friend.
Yeah, like his one buddy. Now, Andrew Sangster argues that Beria begins in the Cheka, quote, a lifelong habit of intrigue against his own superiors in the hope that he could destabilize them to his own advantage. His next boss, Ivan Pavlinovsky, pleaded at staff meetings for his deputy Beria to cease intrigues against him. So, like, during meetings, please stop plotting to overthrow me. Like,
we're trying to do a job. Stop it.
Oh, God. It's
That's
so
a great
funny.
Complaint to have in your employee record. Mm-hmm. Like, I know personally, yeah. I have never been publicly mm-hmm. told at, like, you know, like the firefighters board or mm-hmm. whatever by my captain to please mm-hmm. stop plotting against him.
Please stop plotting my murder. You can't do this anymore. It is really funny. It, you know, again, the death of Stalin, not wildly accurate to the direct history. I do think it gets like the broad strokes of the relationships pretty well.
Yeah.
But the Armando Iannucci, the writer, is also the guy who did Veep, and he did a show that Veep is kind of based on, that was based on UK politics. I always forget the name. And he's like, I want to see him do like a 3-season series about the early Soviet politics and the Caucasus, because you could make a wildly entertaining comedy about this. Like, a lot of people die, but everyone is such a piece of shit. There's all so much backstabbing and overthrowing each other.
I would
have a
love
lot
to
of fun
see like a
this.
Young Stalin treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Koba era shit.
If you ever watched there's a really good TV show, The Great, which is about...
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. What's her name, The Great? Fucking Catherine?
Yes.
Yeah, who's a Tsaritsa? I always forget the proper term when it's the woman, but she's fully in charge. And
Tsarina.
Anyway, Tsarina. But one of the things that show gets really well, and again, wildly inaccurate to the literal... like steps of history, but it gets really well the kind of constant backstabbing and like overthrowing and shit in that's a long time hallmark of Russian politics.
And to its credit, it never even attempts to be accurate, and even says like this is not accurate in like the ticker before the show starts every mm-hmm. episode. It's still fucking wonderful.
It's fun. It's got some great performances by Nicholas Holt, one of my favorite actors. Good shit. Check it out. 3 real solid seasons. So Beria is going to prove no less brutal to his colleagues than he is to the citizens of Azerbaijan and Georgia and Armenia. Sangster writes, quote, the Cheka's main task was to crush any counter-revolutionary group which was interpreted with the widest possible guidelines. It was a time of festering chaos, distrust, and sheer brutality. In 1921, the Troika system was announced, which was a 3-man committee empowered to judge and execute on the spot. And Beria played a major role in such proceedings in his area of responsibility. In his very early 20s, he had become accustomed to having people killed, not in the front line of war, but dragged off the streets or out of their homes and shot in police cells.
That's so much more personal, though.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
Like, there's a difference between a guy who's, you know, seen a lot of conflict and kills people in the trenches of World War One, because that's largely impersonal. And, you know, a soldier's mindset is much different than a guy who's murdering someone in a dank basement.
Yeah. You have at least on your conscience, like, because obviously war fucks people up, but like, yeah, I shot some people because they were shooting at me is different from I pulled this guy away from his family during dinner. This dude I'd worked with for years, and I shot him in the back of the head. Right.
Yeah. Like, they can't fight back. They're in a dank basement. Probably a lot of torture has happened before this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this causes a tremendous amount of paranoia, right? Even among the winners in these conflicts, right? It kind of breaks everybody's mind, right? And the atmosphere grows paranoid enough that occasionally the right people are arrested, right? Sometimes that even happens.
Well, when you arrest enough people, you'll eventually grab someone who's guilty.
Yeah. And one of those people is Beria. Shortly after his appointment to the Cheka, he gets taken into custody by the Cheka under suspicion of anti-revolutionary activity. Now, this was right because he is executing a lot of revolutionaries. But all of the people he's killing pretty much are socialists, right? But this is not accurate in a way they care about, and he is set free and continues to work killing revolutionaries. Now, I've noted a few times, I'm not wildly in love with any single source for these episodes, largely because trying to do a biography of a guy like Beria is just this horrifying task given how much disinfo is pumped out in his lifetime. Knight's book seems pretty good. I've definitely found a couple of conclusions in her book that I've considered shaky. I like Sangster's writing, and I think he's reasonably careful, but he also might be kind of a weird right-winger. Like, just looking at his bibliography, I don't see anything overly insane, but his book contains, like, a casual Jordan Peterson quote.
God.
Yeah. So that was one of those things where, like, well, fuck. And I had, like, looked into the guy and, like, I don't see anything
right.
inherently
Did he ever write any books on Rhodesia at any point?
Yeah. No, his biggest thing is he's, like, obsessed with this guy. Yeah, he's a professor, and he writes this book about Alan Brooke, Churchill's right-hand critic, like this reappraisal of Lord Alan Brooke, who's this World War II British military officer. Like, I don't know much about Alan Brooke, but I don't see anything that's, like, inherently crazy about any of this. So I don't know. I just want to let you know.
Slipping a Jordan Peterson quote into...
That worried me.
Wait, was
right?
that in his book about Beria?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where he, like, it's
that
this
is
quote,
the most out of left field
so
it could possibly
it's,
be.
It immediately made me, like, backtrack and check on a bunch of shit that I had. And again, I didn't run into anything that was, like, obviously wrong. Most of what he said lines up with most of what Knight said. And, like, again,
now
that
I
point where, like,
I just
want to
hear
Knight's
the whole
like,
biography done in Jordan Peterson voice.
Right, yeah.
The thing about Lavrenti Beria.
I didn't love it, yeah. And I've got, like, a couple of different quotes from this, or books that I use for this. Knight's book, Sangster's book. There's another book called On Stalin's Team that I use a lot later that's about, like, the whole gang around Stalin. There's a little bit of...
The Stalin Hype House.
Yeah, the Stalin Hype House. So, like, I tried to be broad with this. And, again, I didn't catch Sangster just lying about anything, but you should know you're not going to find any, like, perfect sources on a guy around whom there's so much disinfo, right? And broadly speaking, the two big things that you can argue about in terms of, like, what kind of guy Beria was that you can support with a lot of evidence. One is he was an absolute psychopath and one of, like, the most unhinged, violent, evil people within the Soviet government. And the other is he was as violent and evil as he had to be to survive within the system. And he was a guy who wanted to maintain power and was willing to do terrible things to keep himself alive, but was not wildly worse than most of his colleagues, which doesn't mean he's good, right? Those are kind of, broadly speaking, the two barriers that you can make a case for.
I could see both with
yes,
the, like the,
I can see
the,
both
the
too.
Caveat of being like, yeah, he was surrounded by just
yeah.
odious,
both are really
hideous
bad.
Human beings.
Yeah.
But there's not many people that rose to the lengths that he did to the Soviet Union
yes.
that, asterisk, that we're aware of,
yeah.
that did the things that he did on his own personal time.
Yes, and that we will be talking about that later as well. It takes a bit to build to that because a lot of that starts to happen, or at least we have documentation of the sex abuse stuff once he hits Moscow, which we're
right.
not at yet, right? So anyway, I just wanted to, like... FYI, you should know this about our sources, you know?
Beria has layers like an ogre.
Yeah, yes, and so do his biographers. And speaking of Sangster, you get lines like this during a discussion of how Beria and his fellow Czechists abuse their powers that I found interesting. Even modern-day police officers in an open liberal democracy sometimes query the activities of their next-door neighbors, and it is understandable that in a ruthless society, the sense of suspicion and doubt increases exponentially.
And what?
He's not wrong in that, like, yeah, modern police officers abuse their powers to spy on, like, women they're stalking and their neighbors
yeah.
and shit all the time. Not
I mean,
a,
to be
not
fair, the NYPD
thing.
Would hire Lavrenti Beria.
Yeah, yeah. It's that part of makes me think, like, well, maybe the Jordan Peterson thing was, like, not evidence of anything sinister, because he is kind of being like, modern cops are terrible in a lot of the same ways Beria was, and I don't disagree, actually.
This is one of those horrible moments, like,
yeah.
even the worst guy in the world is right,
yeah.
you know?
Not inherently an unreasonable caveat.
But there's so many other quotes you could pick before you settle on
yeah.
Jordan fucking Peterson.
It's, you know, my dad likes Jordan Peterson, and my dad, for the record, like... voted for Trump once and didn't the second time and now considers the Republicans to be like a very unhinged and dangerous anti-democratic, like anti-democracy party. But he still thinks Jordan Peterson's like, he's not on Twitter, you know? He doesn't
does
see
he,
any
does
of
your
this
dad
shit.
Have an opinion on the Chinese dick sucking machines that Peterson
no,
posted about?
No, he didn't believe me when I told him that. So you do have to keep in mind there are some normies out there that like casually read Jordan Peterson's self-help book about cleaning your room and were like, great.
I come across that a lot. Like a lot of on like when you meet somebody like for the first time and you ask them like what they're reading, a lot of times it's that, and it's very innocent, and it's because they're not criminally online like we are. They just don't know or are not focused on politics at all, and they just come across a self-help book and they're like, wow, this is really interesting, and it's like, oh, and then you have to give them the bad news about him, and you're like,
he believes the Chinese government is harvesting cum from prisoners.
I'm like, actually, sir, did you know?
And it also means they haven't listened to an interview from Jordan Peterson in the last several years.
No, but
the
man is
completely unhinged.
You know,
it's the book only thing.
I have some like friends who are not online and fairly nice people who like listened to Joe Rogan 10 years ago and are like, yeah, he seems fine. And it's like, well,
yeah.
Like, how much is it worth arguing about this?
Like I myself, the first podcast I ever listened to was Joe Rogan. And, you know, I listened to it for a fair amount of time until like Brett Weinstein and shit started coming on. And I was like, ooh, this is too fucked up for me.
Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't listened to Sangster's podcast appearances, but like I haven't run into anything, at least in his bibliography, that makes me think he's like clearly insane. But people should be aware of this caveat. So even within the Cheka, Beria is controversial. He was accused of repeatedly convicting the wrong people for political gain or plain mean-spiritedness, and for allowing actual political enemies of the new state to escape. Right? Like, he's constantly letting people who are actually trying to, like, bring back the monarchy to get out of jail and executing, like, socialists who had fought against the Tsar.
When you put so much resources into taking out your own political opponents, you kind of miss the broader spectrum of actual political opponents.
Right. And in between executing and arresting basically whoever, he engaged in some light pedophilia.
All right.
Yeah, there we go. We're not getting into like the most problematic stuff, but this is bad. He first met Nina Gegechkori, age 16, through one of her relatives who was a prominent Georgian Bolshevik. He had spent this guy, her relative, had spent time in prison with Beria and apparently told Nina, hey, I was locked up with this weird murderer everybody's scared of. You should go on a date with this guy.
I mean, that's Beria, how I met my first wife.
Sure, right. Who wouldn't, you know, who wouldn't take that pitch?
I mean, it's one more thing he has in common with Stalin.
Yeah, it's one of those
Georgians,
like his,
they
like,
both really like underage girls.
Instead of his online dating profile, instead of like holding up a fish, it's this like bloody dude he's shot in the back of the head. Like, I'm a checkist, you know.
Next to a pickup truck once again.
Yeah,
Texans.
Yeah, and his quotes from Jordan Peterson. So they go on a date or whatever, and Beria proposes soon after. And when they get married in 1921, she is still a child. Now we get different accounts of what. I don't know if you wouldn't call this a meet cute, but we get different accounts of how they actually meet. And none of them are from flawless sources. One story comes from Stalin's daughter, Svetlana Aliluyeva, who was a bit of a mess herself, although it is hard to blame her for that, right?
Yeah, Stalin's her dad.
Stalin is her dad. You get some grace from me for that. She claims that Beria visited Nina's village when he was promoted to the same job that he had for the Cheka in Baku, but in Tbilisi. Nina came to him to beg for her brother's release. Quote, Beria had arrived in a special train. Nina entered his car and never again saw her native village. She was carried off, her beauty having caught the police boss's fancy. He locked her up in a compartment. That was how she became his wife. Now, that's a pretty horrifying story. The timing of Beria's actual promotions with when we know he met Nina doesn't quite match up. Now, it's very likely, in fact, that Svetlana might have the broad strokes right, but have gotten some dates and stuff wrong, you know, wouldn't be weird. Sangster notes, quote, the story Stalin's daughter relates probably grew from the possibility that they had eloped on Beria's train. Despite his sexual predatory nature, the marriage lasted and, quote, she remained in love with her charmer for the rest of her life.
And how many people get whisked away in their own personal train, you know?
Right? I mean, that is pretty romantic if you discount all of the horrible things.
You want to get on my murder train, baby girl?
Yeah. Who doesn't want a murder train, right?
I know. I could go for a murder train. Instead, I have to settle for a public train. Sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
And can't kill a single person on there and get away with it.
Drains. No, no, no. There's cameras. It's fucked up.
Yeah.
So Amy Knight provides a different accounting of events. She notes that Beria met Nina when Nina was 15, and Nina comes to visit her relative in prison when he's locked up with Beria. Beria, from prison, is enraptured by the beauty of this child and remains obsessed with her. When the Bolsheviks take Georgia, Nina moves to Tbilisi with her adopted family, and Beria becomes a regular house guest. Quote, Nina was still young and a lighthearted schoolgirl. She once carelessly joined other students in a demonstration against the Bolsheviks, despite the fact that she was living in the home of a prominent Bolshevik. She later recalled, in an interview given when she was already in her mid-80s, how on that occasion she came home soaking wet because the police had sprayed the student demonstrators with water. Sasha's wife, Mary, was furious, threatening to whip Nina because she had expressed opposition to the Bolsheviks. One day, Beria stopped her on her way to school and asked her to meet him later for a talk. Nina agreed, and when they met, Beria proposed marriage. She recalled, we sat on a bench. Lavrenti was wearing a black top coat and a student's service cap. He told me that for a long time, he had been very taken with me. What is more, he said that he loved me and wanted to marry me. I was 16 years old at the time. And so that's the version of events that she would later give. You know, Nino would later, you see it both as Nino and Nina. That's the version that she would give, right? And in this version of events, which, like, I don't know which of these, all of these are bad because she is a child in all of these. Her recollection of events is that, like, yeah, he kind of like sweeps her off her feet, right?
Noted romantic, like hopeless romantic
Lavrenti Beria.
Yeah.
Now, in this version of events, Beria wanted to go to Belgium to study oil processing for the Soviet government, but they wouldn't send an unmarried man, and she agrees to marry him because it's better to have one's own family than to live in someone else's. Which is not an uncommon story that, like, and again, you have to think this is a different time. She's like living with her parents and under her dad's roof and is like, well, I would rather be the number two person in my household than a child in my household.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not trying to give Beria any slack here, but like that's her recollection of why she makes the call. Right.
And 16 for the era wouldn't have been too out of pocket or anything.
It was not the norm, but it was not something that most people would have considered really problematic either.
Right. It's not like, you know, like the story about Stalin's underage mistress is much more glaring because I believe she was either 13 or 14 or something.
And there's going to be a lot more problematic shit about Beria and underage people and just women in general that's coming later.
This is almost the most innocent thing about him because at least it was romantic.
At least that's how Nino recalls it, right? Now, I want to really emphasize every variant of the story here, including Nino's, agrees that Beria deliberately sought out a child bride, right? Ugh. So calling him a pedophile, very fair.
I take back what I said. Gross.
Her version of events is that, like, I was down because it meant more freedom for me, basically being number two in a household as opposed to a child, which, again, that's what she recalls.
And she gets to go to Belgium. Who doesn't love going to Belgium?
Tragically. Beria never winds up visiting Belgium. This just doesn't happen. In late 1922, he gets transferred to Tbilisi as part of a plan by the Bolsheviks to make their suppression of outlying territories seem less like a foreign occupation by having locals do the mass murdering of dissidents. And again, this is part of why Svetlana's account that he kidnaps her on a train doesn't quite work, because they have already met by the time he's made head of the Cheka, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or deputy head of the Cheka or something like that. There's a lot of different titles he goes through. So by this point, although still pretty young, Beria's personality is fully formed, and his driving motivation seems to be the desire to improve his own situation through cunning and brutal violence. He becomes known for such quotes as, when we Bolsheviks want to get something done, we close our eyes to everything else.
Never a good sign.
Good way to do some mass murdering, I always say. Sophie will tell you, that's my catchphrase, baby. Podcasters are the same way. So Georgian nationalism was still a major force in the area, which threatened Soviet plans to unite it with Azerbaijan and Armenia as a single bloc within the greater USSR. Beria is tasked with crushing this desire for independence. Mensheviks are also murdered en masse, and by 1922, mass graves had become a common sight. Sangster writes, during these early years, Beria proved to be cunning and proficient at seeking out and killing the opposition. Whole families and villages, people with the same surnames or the slightest connections, were murdered by the Cheka and the army. There was no mercy. It amounted to thousands upon thousands of victims. Of his own participation in these crimes, Beria would later write, "Whatever cruelty that the Cheka had to carry out receded, in my youthful conception at the time, into the foggy distance, and I pictured only the difficult, dangerous obligations in the name of humanity's happiness."
Ugh.
This is accurate also to Sam Bankman-Fried, who recently got sentenced to 25 years in prison. If you ever tell anyone, anything that I do is justified because I'm doing it for the happiness of humanity, again, you gotta shoot him. You know?
Yeah, you know, the one thing that really improves humanity's happiness, from my own personal experience, is mass graves.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, who doesn't love a nice mass grave? You can have a picnic on them. It'll
eventually
make
really
flowers grow well.
Flowers, green grass.
People talk about the downside of mass graves all the time, but never any of the benefits. You know, yeah,
everybody's so negative all the time.
Couple generations later, free bones. Who doesn't like bones? You know. Skulls are expensive. I know. My skull guy is fucking taking an arm and a leg out of me these days.
And, you know, so, several generations, you know, thousands of years in the future, boom, oil.
Uh-huh. That's right. Again, it's almost green, Joe. You
it's
know?
About forward
recycling.
Thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You turn them from people who are using oil and polluting to people who are generating oil and
perpetual
not
perpetual energy, baby.
Mm-hmm. 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 It's like a solar panel. So Beria's thoroughness earned him the respect of Stalin, who was known to deport several loyal Bolsheviks to the East for the crime of not getting along with Beria. In one case, Beria asked for a deported rival to be recalled to Tbilisi so that he could beat the man for fun. Other gifts given to Beria for his service in 1922 included a gold watch for courage and a pair of Browning automatic rifles, which is a legitimately rad gift.
A pair?
Yeah, a pair. Can't just have one bar, man. You gotta double down on that shit.
You got Barry a fucking bars akimbo, which is like the ultimate version.
Fuck. So by the spring of 1922, the Federation of Trans-Caucasian Republics, which Beria and his colleagues had battered into submission on Moscow's orders, was inducted into the USSR as a single entity. The actual road to this point was so brutal. Again, they have to kill all of these Armenian and Azeri and Georgian nationalist politicians and all of these like kind of middle of the road social democrats who had wanted their wanted independent Armenian or Azeri republics, right? Or Georgian republics. You have to kill all of these people, right? And this means that like Beria and his colleagues are murdering so many people that Lenin becomes aware of how many people have been massacred to avoid. And this isn't just to avoid them entering the USSR. A lot of these people are killed to avoid having them join the USSR as separate Caucasus states, right? Right. For whatever reason, this is important. And Lenin gets kind of pissed off and he demands the Cheka cease its violence in Georgia. Now, this is going to be a pattern. Every time there's like a mass purge that kills a shitload of people, whoever's running the USSR will have to, once it ends, punish the people who did the massacre in order to like try and make the survivors not rebel, basically. Right.
And it's like, kind of impressive because like Lenin is a guy who really fucking hated the Caucasus. And even he was like, Whoa, slow down there, buddy.
You killed how many people? Come on, man. And I think part of why he's pissed is that like he is aware that a lot of the people who get killed were people who like made the revolution happen, right? And then get murdered. Now, by then, most of the people who might have provided resistance to an ambitious man like Beria were dead, and he used his position in Georgia as an engine to propel himself upwards into the hierarchy of the USSR. During this time, revolutionary fervor was still fresh, and men like Beria were expected to live somewhat experimental lifestyles in line with their radical beliefs. Private displays of wealth were frowned upon, and Beria eventually formally requested to share quarters with his boss because communal living was seen as proper communist stuff. Again,
God, what a terrible roommate.
Yeah, horrible roommate. He's planning to kill you constantly. Actually, it's a lot like most roommates I've had.
Yeah, that's fair.
So he spends a significant amount of time with lower-ranking Chekists, which historian Antonov Ovsinko notes was absolutely to spy on them. Quote, "At first, everyone trusted Lavrenty Beria completely, but upon knowing him better, they were not able to be friendly with him. He was a master of intrigue and denunciation. Like no one else, he was able at the right moment to unleash a nasty rumor in order to ensnare his rivals on the way to the top. Then he would persecute them one by one. In doing so, the young Beria, whenever necessary, would convincingly play the role of a good old chap, simple and jolly." That's how we remember him. Jolly old Beria.
I always think of Lavrenty Beria as a jolly old chap. And then, like, has this guy ever been in a room with anyone he wasn't actively spying on?
Well, no, but, you know, who amongst us hasn't constantly spied upon our bosses and subordinates in order to... Sophie, hey, present company excluded. Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, I have like three guys going through my producer's trash as we speak.
Normal stuff. Speaking of normal, Joe, that's the end of part one of four. What do you got for plugs to be plugged?
I am the host of the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast. We talk about military disasters, crazy stories from military history, and also all around horrible shit, much like your show. And I'm also a science fiction author, and you can find my newest series, The Undying Legion, anywhere that you procure your books from.
Yeah. Well, check out Joe's books, check out Joe's podcast, and, you know, get really good at digging if you intend to get into revolutionary politics, you know? Always good to be able to dig a big hole, you know? A lot of things you can do with a hole. A lot of things you can put in a hole. So,
well, supervisors you can put in a hole.
Supervisors, wow. Your boss, wow. Your roommate, wow. Your roommate boss. Put them all in the hole.
That guy
you put
them
in
dislike.
The hole, the problem's gone. Yeah, that guy you dislike. That guy you like. Everyone
especially
goes in the
if
hole.
You like them.
Yeah, yeah. That's the number one person to put in a hole. Anyway, this has been Behind the Bastards. Goodbye.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.